Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm about to interview the guy who's got the best COVID haircut that I've ever seen. Dude, you didn't cut that yourself, did you?
No, I was actually down in Mexico, quarantined, and the only person that I got to see besides my ex-wife and my kids was a trainer because he lived right next door. And so one day we were boxing and I was like, I've always wanted a mohawk. He's like, now's the time, if ever. So he shaved me a mohawk. And yeah,
look at that.
Yeah.
It's kind of a wide mohawk. I feel like
mohawks are a wide mohawk. Yeah, I think he was a little bit nervous. It was the first haircut he ever gave, and maybe his last. And so he didn't want to go too narrow. So, but it was also a little while ago. It's grown out some. It was a little bit more intense.
Is it wrong to say you're a good looking guy to say that as I was looking at reading your book, I looked at a photo of your family, every freaking one of them, it looks good. Even your mom, nobody's mom looks good. Like when you're an adult, you were 29 years old in that photo. Your mom looked good. Your dad looked good. Your brother, your sister.
I'm actually talking to my mom later today about some stuff. So I'm going to tell you said that.
I'm too embarrassing. All right. Let me introduce the person whose voice you just heard. His name is Blake Mikowski. Mikowski, excuse me. Why am I adding a W to it?
That's fine.
Blake Mikowski. He is the founder of Tom's Shoes. This guy made these slip-on shoes that kind of got everyone's attention because every time somebody bought a pair of shoes, he donated a pair of shoes to somebody in need. The company, I just checked their website, they donated 86 million pairs of shoes over the years. They've added other products, which means that also using the one-for-one model, they have helped restore eyesight for 600,000 people. They have provided over 600,000 weeks of safe drinking water, supported safe births for 25,000 mothers, sold the company for reported $625 million in value?
Yep.
Wow. And do you sell the whole company eventually or just half to Bain at that valuation?
Yeah, just half to Bain.
All right. And today he is here. Not because he wants me to evaluate the looks of his family and his COVID haircut, but because he's got a brand new product. It's called Made For, and his goal is to help people improve themselves. He's got a 10-week program, and it's not one of these 10-week programs that's just online video and online email. He's actually sending you something in the mail.
Yeah, and it's totally analog. There's no digital app. There's no website that you interact with besides when you sign up. That's the only time you'll ever kind of be online with Made For in our program. It's 100% analog and it comes to your house, which is great during
quarantine. Right. So you get something to play with it.
Yeah.
That's not your phone. Like what? What's an example of something that you mail out to people?
So yeah. So like we focus on basic habits and practices that frankly we've all heard and we all know about, but so few of us actually have integrated into our life in a sustainable way. So one of the simplest months of the 10 months, but one that really helps from a neuroplasticity standpoint of get you accustomed to doing something every day with intention is the hydration month. And so we found that when we did a bunch of research and met with a bunch of scientists as we were building this program, that 65% of Americans are chronically dehydrated and they don't even realize it. And what that does is it affects everything in their life. It affects their sleep. It affects, you know, how their organs work. It affects their energy levels. And so we have a whole month that literally is about drinking water and how much water to drink and debunking some of the myths around electrolytes and
water.
So then
what do you send me in? Before I say that, I should tell people that this interview is sponsored by two great companies. The first is ClickFunnels. They don't want me to tell you that they've got a great landing page that will turn strangers into email subscribers and customers. Instead, they want me to tell you that they've got a new podcast called Traffic Secrets. And the second, if you're trying to create your own business, I'm going to tell you later why you should sign up for HostGator. My goal for this interview is to find out a little bit about Blake's backstory, the stuff that he did, the businesses that he ran before he launched Tom's, and then to understand how he took his story, his vision, and he made it tangible for people. He created events, or his people created events. He created, he made news. And I want to know how he took his story and got all of us to talk about it. And I've got this great example from my wife and what she did. And then also to find out a little bit about what he's doing now. So the question that I was asking you before I interrupted with that intro is, why can't you just say to me, Andrew, drink more water. Here's the danger of not drinking water. Good luck. Good. You've got a cup at home. You got a water bottle. Yeah. What are you sending me?
Because everyone has done that. And still we have an issue with 65% of people are chronically dehydrated. So what we send you each month is a kit that that includes three things. The first thing is about, it's a little book. It's about 20 to 25 minutes to read. It's all the consolidated science on why water is so important. And it really gives a stronger case, and really not that it would scare you by not drinking water, but it really shows how critical this is in your life. The second thing is we've designed a tool. In this case, it's a specific water bottle that keeps track of how much water you're drinking throughout the day. So a lot of people carry a water bottle around. And at the end of the day, if I asked you, how many bottles did you drink? You might have no idea. And one day you might have drinking five or six and you feel great that day. And the other day you don't feel so good and you don't realize you only drink one bottle that day. So we have a water bottle in this case. It's a beautiful glass bottle with a silicone cover and it keeps track of how much water. And then the third thing in the kit is the challenge card. And that's kind of a way to keep track of how you're progressing throughout the month. And it also has a little bracelet that you wear on your wrist that reminds you of your commitment that month. And so each month we focus on a different habit or practice that will have an impact on your either physical, mental, or kind of spiritual life. And what we do is we send these kits once a month, so you have the whole month to work on it.
Got it. And you've tested this. You've got some interesting results. I want to.
Yeah, it's been fascinating. I mean, we worked with the head of the neuroscience lab at Stanford when we started building the program, and then he introduced us to several other labs across the country and many different disciplines. At Harvard, we worked with the head of psychology. We worked with the woman at UC Davis on sleep. And so what we're finding is now that we've done 1300 beta testers, the most interesting thing is focusing on people's baselines, these very simple habits and practices actually have effects in people's lives that we never even anticipated in the program. So, two of my favorite ones is, one of the things that's fascinating is there's nothing in the program about weight loss. But we have so many people that say, I finally lost the 20 pounds that I've always wanted to lose. And we have nothing about weight loss, but because they started focusing on all these other things, sleep, gratitude, breath, hydration with more intention, that intention naturally changed their mindset from a fixed mindset of I cannot lose these 20 pounds to a growth mindset of if I can change my habits around water and hydration and sleep, yeah, then I can lose 20 pounds. And so that's kind of an example of something that's not necessarily in the program, but the benefits come from changing people's mindset through these intentions.
I get that. I get it. When I make progress in one area of my life, I feel more confident and more capable, and that momentum also builds in other parts of my life. Let me ask you something. Were you somebody who as a kid was listening to a lot of self-improvement people? Do you have those Tony Robbins CDs at your house? You did?
I did. You did. Yeah, like Zig Ziglar. And, yeah. Yeah, I was. I mean, it's funny. I'm not really as a kid. I would say what happened, I mean, my entrepreneurial story is I was wanting to be a professional tennis player. My whole life, all I did was train for tennis. I lived at tennis academies in high school, didn't even live at home.
Self-improvement tapes and books around tennis?
Yeah, it was all focused on tennis. And then I had an injury that stopped my tennis career my sophomore year in college. And I broke had a really bad injury to my leg. And I, in the process, ended up starting my first business because I had all this free time, and that was a laundry business. And I did that because I couldn't do my own laundry because I was on crutches, and I realized a lot of kids didn't want to do their laundry. And
what was the laundry business?
What's that?
What was the laundry business?
It's called Easy Laundry. And okay. So it's pick up and delivery laundry on college campuses. And we did it at about five universities. And I bring that up because what happened was, is I dropped out of college my sophomore year, and I never knew anything about business. My dad wasn't in business. I wasn't in business. And so I really kind of zeroed in on reading biographies of successful entrepreneurs. And what I also did was I realized that a big part of being an entrepreneur was like your mindset and positivity and being able to sell and present yourself well. And so that's when all the Zig Ziglar tapes and Tony Robbins tapes and all that stuff infiltrated my brain. And I'm super thankful that it did, because I mean, really, that stuff, it works. Like if you really, your mind is such a powerful tool.
How did you apply it back then? I remember listening to it and it would just put me in a good frame of mind. But other than taking Tony Robbins CDs and going through his assignments in a Word doc, I don't think I did much.
Well,
what did you do?
I don't know. As I think about it, I'm not sure if I did a lot as much as I just think it helped me think differently. I think you know, listening to those things. I used to listen to them like on like cassette tapes in my car. I mean, it shows how old I am, right? And so I think it was more of, you know, just having positive thinking constantly funneling through your brain, at least for me, versus just, you know, zoning out on country music or something when I was living in Nashville at the time. Like that I think had an effect, and it just created that positivity and that I can do attitude. But if I'm really honest, I think most of my entrepreneurial drive and discipline really comes from my tennis days. I mean, I was like the most, you know, at age 13, 14, 15. I mean, I was so focused on trying to be a professional athlete. And so
why didn't you become cynical? Why didn't you say, I tried, I gave it everything? They say, if you give it everything, then you're going to make it. I believed in myself. I thought that I was going to do it. I failed. Yeah. It doesn't really matter anymore.
Well, I never really, and maybe this is the tapes, I never really see anything that didn't work as a failure, you know? Like,
you weren't bitter that this tennis experience didn't work out?
I got to travel the world. I got to have incredible experiences, you know, wins and losses, and learn a lot about myself. And, you know, when I was 19 years old and had this injury and realized like, okay, that's the writing on the wall, then I was able to apply it to something else. And I don't think I was as like introspective at that age. You know, now it's easy to look back and kind of, you know, even almost like retell the story with a great more deal of introspection. But I think it was just like, wow, like, okay, I can't play tennis anymore. My laundry's piling up. I don't know how to do it because I'm on crutches. I can't carry it to the laundry place. I'm going to start this laundry business. And then before I knew it, I had 40 employees and it was like a real business. And then I was like, shit, I got to learn about business. So I started reading, you know, all these great biographies, whether it was, you know, Sam Walton or Richard Branson or Howard Schultz or Mary Kay. I mean, these were the things I started reading. And I learned a lot from their journeys and their stories. And I know we're going to talk about story at some point.
Let me go through a little bit more backstory here. Yeah. You told Fortune magazine about 10 years ago that you sold your share of Easy Laundry and then you went and created an outdoor media company. Who else was there? If it's not just your share,
I mean, my roommate was my partner. Yeah.
So. Got it. All right. So you sold it. Your roommate stayed on.
Yeah. He stayed on and he ran it for many years after. Then he sold it to another company and it still runs today. If you go to these universities, you'll see those trucks driving around.
And that's something you started.
Yeah. 24 years ago. It's still in business.
What's the outdoor media company that Clear Channel eventually bought up?
So that was an interesting thing. So I went to Los Angeles. I was thinking about actually going back to college because I didn't finish in Dallas at SMU. And I'd sold the laundry business. And I was, you know, at that time I was 20 or 21 years old. And I thought, you know, a lot of my friends are still in school. Maybe I'll go back. But I didn't want to go back to Dallas. I was thinking maybe, you know, West Coast. And I was in California in Los Angeles. And I saw these massive advertisements on the sides of buildings, you know, like they have in Times Square and I had never seen that. We didn't have any of those in Texas and Dallas where I grew up. And I was amazed at how powerful they were. Like you could not avoid, you know, in a day where you can block out so much advertising, you could not avoid this massive dinosaur for the new Jurassic Park movie on the side of the building. And so I was just fascinated that how effective that was and that didn't exist in the cities that I had grown up in. And at the time, I had just started one of my laundry businesses in Nashville, Tennessee. And part of my deal was when I sold it, that I would continue to manage that operation until we found a GM. And that was probably going to be 6 months to a year. And I noticed that in Nashville that you had every country music artist that lived there. And they all had, you know, pretty big egos. And so I had this idea that if I put one of them on the side of a building, and the other ones had to drive by and see Garth Brooks every day, then they would want their own building because they would not want just Garth to have his face on the side of a building. And it worked. So I actually went around the city and I got contracts to rent the sides of all the big buildings downtown. And I went to the music labels and said, hey, I can put the Dixie Chicks for their next album release. And I was getting like $20,000, $30,000 cash a month per building. I mean, it was crazy. And yeah, because I mean, this was the greatest advertising, you know, in the city, and we had the ego factor. And so I started that. I ran it for a couple of years, and then Clear Channel bought it out, and that was my first, I would say, kind of financial success as an entrepreneur.
How much was that?
Ultimately, it was about $4 million. So
what'd you do? How did your life change when you had $4 million in your 20s?
Well, I didn't have it. The deal was, it was a, because the way that outdoor advertising works is, you know, a lot of it is based on permits from the city. And so you can't represent you're going to get the permit every year. Like you got to be a, you got to be on good standing with the city and make sure you're not putting up anything that's distasteful and stuff like that. So the way a lot of times outdoor advertising companies get sold, especially small ones, is it's like a multiple. So I got checks for like 18 years or something.
So there was no one moment.
It changed my life. It just gave me a nice allowance, so to speak, you know, every month.
Did it give you the confidence then to say, I can do anything because I did this and I'm not going to go poor. I got money.
Yeah,
I know,
definitely. And definitely that was the moment when I was like, okay, I can now really set out and try to start interesting things and live as an entrepreneur. I moved out to California and I kind of never looked back.
You had a DMV business, but before, or no, a driver's ed business, but before that, after the outdoor media company, what was the next thing? What was the third business?
I tried to start a reality cable channel. So one of the entrepreneurs I really looked up to was Ted Turner, still do.
Yeah,
I read all his books. I lived on a sailboat myself, was an avid sailor. He obviously got his start in outdoor advertising. I got my start in outdoor advertising. And so I thought, well, if Ted could start CNN at such a young age, then maybe I could start a reality cable channel. Now, this is when the reality craze was just at its all-time high. I was on a reality show, The Amazing Race. So I had a firsthand experience of kind of the 15 minutes of fame. And so, yeah, so I convinced the founder of the E! Channel to join me. And we set out to launch a cable network, which proved to be an incredibly difficult thing to do. And after about 3 to 4 years, we were basically out of business, ran out of cash. So that
Why?
Was
why do you think?
Well, Rupert Murdoch and Fox, about 2 years into our journey, announced that they were going to launch Fox Reality, and they did. And so all the operators, they don't need two reality channels. Mm. So we were funded, but not funded at the level of Fox. And Fox had so much of the programming already in the can. So it just became very clear. And so we had a really hard time getting distribution deals. If you don't have distribution deals, you can't get advertisers. You can't get advertisers, you're out of business. So that was that was a big public failure. I lost, you know, a lot of money myself. Other people lost a lot of money. It was a really challenging experience. And, you know, there were some dark days after that.
What's a dark day? Let me just not put you out there as the guy who looks great, has success after success. And when there's a failure, you just see it as a learning experience. I see even the way that you're carrying yourself as we're talking about this. It was painful. What's the dark day for you?
Well,
what happened?
I've had two real bouts with, I would say, very mild, not very mild, but mild depression. Mm-hmm. And one of them was then, and then one of them was in 2015, which we can talk about because that led to Made For. But this time specifically, what it was for me was I just felt so bad. I felt so much personal responsibility for the 40 plus employees I had to let go and that had, you know, left jobs that were quite secure to join this cable startup based on my vision and my promises, because I had no anticipation of anything but success. And so that was really weighed on me. And I was young. I was 26, 25, 26 years old. And so I just had a tremendous amount of pressure on myself. And that led to things like not eating, not wanting to get out of bed, over consuming alcohol to kind of numb it and deal with it in a non-healthy way. And that went on for, you know, a couple months, and eventually, you know, like all things, they passes and
it just passed on its own.
Yeah. Yeah. I you know, it was really, I went to a therapist, I did some traditional stuff. A lot of it really was, you know, just taking the time to, you know, really process everything. And then also being really well supported by the employees that I had to let go, and them really showing me that they had no hard feelings and that this happens, and, you know, just kind of learning some grown up entrepreneur lessons more than anything else. And so, it did eventually pass. And part of what passed is kind of like a relationship, right? Like one of the best ways to get over a heartbreak is to find someone else, right? And so that's kind of in the entrepreneur world, that's kind of what happened too, is that's when I started the online driver's ed company. And
I have a big question about that. Let me take a moment, because you explained it in your book, which then made me, all right, Let me first talk about my first sponsor and then come back and ask you my big question about the driver's ed thing, the driver's ed business. My first sponsor is a company called HostGator. Let me ask you this. We're now going through a recession, maybe a depression, but still creators are creating online businesses. If you were to start over today with no money, nothing except for a hosting package from, say, HostGator, my sponsor, what idea would you have or how would you get started? If you were starting from scratch, you just had the time to build a site, build a movement, build a story and create something. What would that be?
In terms of what type of business or what
is there a business idea? Is there an approach you would take?
I mean, I think the most, you know, it's interesting. I think the most important thing right now is, I mean, your website is, I mean, it's, you know, business cards used to be somewhat important back in the day when I first started. But I mean, now your website is everything, you know, I mean, it allows anyone from the world to know what you're doing, to understand what you're doing. It allows, you know, people in the countries you sell in to buy. And so having a dependable website is critical.
I would even say a website, even for the little ideas that are kind of flimsy. I'll give you an idea of what I'm talking about. Yeah. The other day, my kids at night couldn't stop asking me questions about insects. Now I got Google, so I start Googling. But number one, not everything's in Google. Like apparently nobody is asked and answered the question of what happens if a bee stinger ends up on the floor and you took it and you stuck it into somebody's finger, would they then get a bee sting and the same thing? Couldn't find the answer to that. So I went on Twitter and I said, does anybody know of an entomologist who can answer all these freaking questions that my kids can't answer? Somebody said, yes, I do know someone. He introduced me to Dr. Drew from the San Diego Zoo. I said, would you get on Zoom with my kids? He gets on Zoom with my kids.
Come
my
on.
Kids, we, no, yeah, unbelievable.
Yeah.
He gets on Zoom with my kids, and then I invite a couple of their friends on, not a big crowd, but just a couple of their friends, and he answers it. Sure enough, you know what? Like, if you do find a stinger and you put it into somebody's finger, yes, absolutely. In the stinger is that that stuff. And yes, they will have the same experience.
Wow.
Here's the other thing you should know. Don't just take out the stinger with tweezers. What you want to do is take a credit card and squeeze out the stuff that the bee puts in your thumb. Anyway, this guy was fantastic. Even brought a little snake that he had in his house who was supposed to eat, had him eat a little tiny mouse so my kids can see that. Showed us all his animals at home.
What a lovely guy. I love these stories that are happening during COVID-19. It's like some people have been so generous with their time and connecting online like this. I mean, I know there's been so much suffering, but there's just those stories just warm my heart.
He loves it. And he's trying to think of what do I do next? So I said, let's get on a call later this week and we'll just talk through. One of the things I'll tell him is put up a website of how you will do this daily for people.
Yeah.
Let them pay to get on. I pay to have my kids. They were entertained for an hour.
Yeah.
And then see where that goes. All right. If you're listening to me and you've got any ideas, don't look for the great idea. Just go and put out anything. Think of it as a sketchbook. One of the best things that I saw from Blake was an old notebook where he sketched out the first version of what his shoes would look like if he created a company.
Yeah.
That's the way you should think about your website. Not this thing that is put out there on the world for forever and ever. It's just a sketch. And then see if it takes off the way that Tom's did after Blake's sketch. All right. If you want to get started with it, they've got a hosting package. It's super cheap, very reliable. Super inexpensive, I should say, and reliable. And they'll give you the lowest price possible if you go to HostGator.com/Mixergy. HostGator.com/Mixergy. All right. So I've got your book here, Start Something That Matters. In it, you say, I had to leave my driver's ed business to go and start this shoe company. Here's the thing. You describe it as an online driver's ed company that is, what's the type of car that it's online?
Oh, yeah. Only use Priuses. That was the very first hybrid. Yeah.
Right. That people needed to have hybrids and do online. How does all this work together?
Well, the real secret sauce to the online driver's ed business was really two things. One was this was right when all the teenagers were on MySpace, even before Facebook.
Yep.
And so it was very easy to reach kids, very targeted, and let them know that they don't have to go and do the boring classroom stuff anymore. They can do it online. And we had a pretty fun, interactive kind of class. And from a testing perspective, it actually got better results because the kids had to pay attention and pass the quizzes to get to the next section. So that was a real, like, technologically, that was a breakthrough because it's the first time that kids didn't have to go to like an old department store or Sears or somewhere to do driver's ed.
Wait, and you were teaching them the written part of the test, not the driving part.
The driving was the real innovation because we did teach them driving, just like every other driver's ed company in the country. We had the written part and then we had the driving part. But the biggest complaint that we heard from teenagers about their driver's instructors was they were boring. They were like retired people. They had nothing in contact with them. And like they would even go as far as say, like, it's an old man that stinks. Like, I, you know, they just did not enjoy that experience. So I don't know when I got this idea, I was probably in the shower or something, you know, random, but I thought, what do teenage girls and boys care the most about? And that is, you know, good looking people. And so I hired Abercrombie and Fitch models on their time off to be driver's ed teachers. So I had like the hottest driver ed teachers. I mean, like literally these girls would like swoon for their driver. They would all want pictures with them. Then they would put them on MySpace and then those pictures would go viral. And then that's how all the advertising happened for the driver's ed.
And that was in person?
Yeah. Yeah. So we just, cause I, it was in LA. And so there are all these models and actresses that need extra revenue. Right. And they need flexible schedules cause they have castings all the time. So we could offer very flexible work, great hourly pay. And yeah, and we became, I mean, the fastest growing driver's ed company in California, like overnight.
Ah, got it. I thought it was an all online thing. It seems like you sold online, but
the driving you did with a hot Abercrombie and Fitch model.
Oh, that's all right. That's amazing. All right. Why don't we do a quick summary of how Tom started? I was going to do it, but I feel like you should do it. And then I want to move on to the stories that you created and you brought to life as you built up Tom's.
Well, Tom's, you know, it's interesting. I mean, it's now 14 years ago when I started it. And like you said, we've given almost 100 million shoes away. And it's been this just incredible journey and experience and has affected so many ways that entrepreneurs think and building purpose into their business. But if you go back 14 years ago, it started from a very, very humble idea. I mean, I was basically in Argentina on vacation. I saw lots of kids on the streets that should have been in school. They didn't have shoes. I inquired about it because I'm just a curious person and found that many of the kids couldn't afford the school uniform, which included a pair of shoes to go to school. And at the same time, I discovered this slip-on shoe that all the farmers and polo players' girlfriends were wearing around town that I thought was super cool. You know, all I knew about slip-ons was really Vans back, you know, when I grew up. And this was very different looking, very light. Oops, let me just turn this off. And so anyway, so I had this idea. It was really simple. I said, what if we took these shoes that are everyone's wearing in Argentina that no one's wearing in the United States? We brought them back. We changed the design a little bit, made them a little bit more substantial, a little bit more comfortable. We sell them in the U.S. And every time we sell a pair in the U.S., we give a pair to a kid here in Argentina so they can have the shoes they need for school. And it was just a really simple idea. And I did it. I didn't even call it a business. I called it a project. It was called the Shoes for Tomorrow Project. And it was really just something that I thought would be fun. I was kind of at a stage where I'd been starting and building companies for, at that point, 10 years already. And I really was connected to some of these people that I met in Argentina. I loved being down there myself. So it was lifestyle wise, it was great. And started very simply, just making the shoes in a guy's garage in Argentina and selling them out of my apartment in Venice, California.
And why didn't you think this is going to be a distraction? I've got a business going. I'm traveling. I think at the time you were retracing your footsteps through the Amazing Race. Great show, by the way. I haven't seen it in years, but it's great. Why did you say I need this other thing? I'm going to learn how to make shoes. I'm going to learn how to sell shoes.
I think for me, I've always been driven by my curiosity and just like disruptive ideas. Like it's never, ever been about making money or a business or a business plan. I mean, that's not my background or training. Like when I started the online driver's ed, it was because one of the people that worked for me in the reality cable channel at a company barbecue, I talked to her 15-year-old son and he was like complaining about his driver's ed experience. And I was thinking, wow, like, you know, if this kid's not that engaged when he's learning to drive, that makes our roads even less safe, you know, when on the highways, because he's probably not paying attention. And, you know, so all my ideas, I mean, from laundry to, you know, outdoor advertising that capitalized on country Western egos to trying to start a reality channel to driver's ed to then Tom's, they've all been in industries that I have no experience in. You know, I don't have any credibility in a sense. But they've all been driven by kind of just falling in love with an idea. And when I had this idea for Tom's about a shoe company that would sell a pair and give a pair so that people who needed shoes would get them when people bought shoes that they wanted, it just was like It was like a beautiful, I mean, it sounds a little cheesy, but it was like this beautiful like equation had been like uncovered in my mind. And I was like, wow, this is like, now looking back, because so many companies have emulated similar models and it's such a part of our business culture. But back then it was so radical. I mean, people were like, you're going to do what? How are you going to make money?
Where did you come up with that idea?
I was just on the farm. You know, I was on the farm. I was drinking some coffee in the morning. I was thinking about some kids that this nonprofit was helping get shoes and how their model was not very sustainable because it was all based on donations. And I just had the idea. Wrote it in my journal.
It wasn't something that you seen anyone else do. It was just inspiration.
It's more like a what if. It was kind of like, what if there was a shoe company that every time they sold a pair, they gave a pair. And then I shared the idea with my polo teacher of all people who became my business partner. And he's like, that's an amazing idea. You should do it. Cause he knew I was an entrepreneur. And I was like, yeah, it actually could be a business and let's, you know, why not? Let's give it a try. And like I said, it started with such humble. I mean, we weren't thinking about carrying a company. We're thinking about, you know, helping hundreds of kids, not millions of kids.
I saw that. It was just a few hundred shoes.
Yeah. 200 shoes. 260.
This is 200. This is Alejo Nitti.
Yeah.
Did he end up continuing to own a piece of the business?
For about, gosh, I think he was involved the first 3 or 4 years. And then it was just, he got married and it was very hard for him to travel as much. And so I ended up buying him out and he's been retired polo player ever since.
So you bring it back to the US in a duffel bag, right?
Yep.
You have to go and figure out, how am I going to sell this? I remember living in Los Angeles. Everybody seemed to either be in the movies or want to be in the movies, or they wanted to be in fashion somehow.
Yeah.
It's hard to get anyone it's hard to get buyers to pay attention to you when you're trying to sell new clothes. How did you get anyone to pay attention to you?
Yeah. So, you know, I went to several places at first and did not have any luck. And then I went to a store called American Rag, which is on La Brea and is a very popular store in terms of kind of the latest trends in fashion. And, I went and met with the shoe buyer and, you know, the first thing I did rather than pull out the shoes out of my bag is I pulled out some pictures from the kids that I had given shoes to. And I told her the story. And I mean, it probably didn't matter what the shoes looked like after I told her the story. She was totally hooked and she said, I'll do it. And that became my first customer.
All right. So then that brings me to the way that you tell your story. You said over and over in your book how important stories are. And I agree with you. I feel a lot of entrepreneurs don't get that. When they sit down here with me, all they want to do is go through facts and bullet points and preach. And nobody is going to listen to that. They want to hear the story and learn for themselves. What you did, though, as I researched your story, was I noticed you keep bringing stories to life. Like, for example, maybe one of the earliest things that you did was you wore mismatched shoes. This is kind of a smaller example. Why did you wear mismatched shoes?
Because if I wore a pair of red Toms on the left foot and a pair of blue Toms on the right foot, then for sure, without a doubt, like I did this a lot in the subway in New York City, because that was where, you know, I was a lot trying to sell the shoes. Someone's going to ask you, they're like, no one does that. They're like, what's with the two shoes? You know, like that's just becomes, it caused them to ask. And if someone asks you, then now that gave me permission, you know, to use kind of a Seth Godin term, it gave me permission to tell them my story. Well, I'm wearing these two different shoes because I started this company called Tom's. And every time we sell a pair, we give a pair to a child in need. And I happen to like both these colors. And so I put two on today. I mean, it's like that simple. But it's amazing how if you create opportunities as a business or as an entrepreneur for people to ask you, I think this is a critical part. And I don't know if I covered this in the book because that was written, you know, 10 years ago. And I think further crystallized my thinking around story I believe firmly that having a really authentic, powerful story is worth its weight in gold in starting a business. But also what's important is to find natural ways for people to inquire, because like you said, people don't want to be preached at. And so, you know, finding ways for people to ask you about the story is, I think, super important. And that's where I wear the mismatched shoes.
Okay. The Airstream, you traveled for what? Let me see. 60 days. What did you do in the early days? 60 days in your Airstream.
Man, those are good memories. Oh man. Yeah. So, I mean, we didn't have any money really for marketing. We had a bunch of shoes. We had some new stores across the country that signed up with us. And I knew I mean, let me just say this first. The quality of the original Tom shoes was crap. Like, these shoes didn't always fit very good. They weren't that comfortable. I mean, we were just learning how to make them. We were making them in this guy's garage in Argentina. And so if you just put the shoe on the shelf next to a Vans or a Converse or a Birkenstock, I don't think very many people were going to buy this shoe. What sells this shoe is the story. And so we were getting a lot of press, and so we were selling a lot of shoes online. And because of that, you know, some department stores and stores wanted to carry us because they saw, you know, we were in Vogue magazine, we were in Elle magazine, we were in the LA Times. And so I said, great, I'll sell you the shoes, but unless you have a way of sharing the story, I don't think they're going to sell just on their own. Like, their shoe itself in the early day wasn't going to do that. And so my idea was, is for me and my intern, Zach, to go in this Airstream and to visit every single store from LA and New York and back in 60 days. And the store would host a party where people would come and I would share a slideshow of my trip to Argentina and we would tell the story. And that was how we launched the business, because not only did every person come emotionally connect the brand to me, to the story, and buy one or two pairs, but they were all like never heard anything like this. So then they would post about it on Facebook or MySpace or whatever back then. And then they would learn about it. And then it was amazing. I mean, it's so interesting talking about this now, because so much of business has caught on to this now. And so many people have, you know, are now doing it, unfortunately, in an inauthentic way. But back then it was just raw. It was powerful. It was disruptive. And people couldn't help but share it with everyone they knew.
And the raw and powerful part was, yes, we're a business, but I'm not going to sell you shoes. I'm going to tell you about these people who don't have shoes and why it matters, how sick they can get from the dirt that they're walking on, how they can't go to school.
Photoconiosis or lots of diseases you get through your feet. Yeah.
And by the way, a good way to help is if you buy a shoe, we give away a shoe. That was the thing. How did you get anyone to even show up to these events to come to
the
store?
Nice thing was, is the stores did all that, right? Because the stores had bought the inventory, so they had a very big vested interest in selling the shoes.
Okay.
And, you know, most people who own shoe companies don't offer to come hang out at your store for the evening. And so they were like, wow, you're going to show up like in an Airstream and like answer questions and like take pictures of people. And I mean, so it was pretty easy for them to, you know, back then to, you know, put flyers up and say, hey, the founder of this company is coming. And news started to travel. I mean, you know, that's right when that was like literally 2007 was when YouTube went live, when Facebook started going off campuses. I mean, this was the birth of social media. And so we naturally just totally, I mean, we were such a native company in social media. I mean, now I think about how social media is such a huge part of everyone's marketing. Like back then, it was just us telling the story and helping other people tell our story. And it was so authentic and raw.
What was the core philosophy that allowed you to innovate on social?
Well, that's the thing. There was no, like, all these challenges that, frankly, you know, that we try to think about now, even with the new company Made For, like, those weren't even, I mean, it wasn't even a thought about strategy or innovation or whatever. It's just like, there's this new platform where you can put videos and people will watch them. So let's make videos of us giving shoes to kids and people will watch them. And then all of a sudden they shared them millions of times. And then next thing you know, you're getting more impressions than Nike is with their ad budget.
And it's because you just said, we're going to tell our story and then we'll see where it goes. And then I remember talking to Guy Kawasaki around the time that you launched, and he said, nurture your thunder lizards. I said, what do you mean? He goes, these are the people who are just so rabid in their devotion to your company that you want to almost push them away because they're a little too eager.
Yeah,
but they come up with the great ideas. In fact, before I say what one of your thunder lizards came up with, let me take a moment to talk about my second sponsor. And then I also want to know, would this work today with Made For in a world where everyone seems to be, well, let me talk about my second sponsor. Right. Yeah. It's a company called ClickFunnels. They've got a podcast all about marketing for people who are listening to me. It's called Traffic Secrets. If you're listening to this and you guys like what we're talking about here when it comes to marketing, they do social media marketing and other marketing. In fact, like one of the things that Russell Brunson, I think he's going to build a $1 billion business. He's probably close. He's over $100 million in revenue now annually from this landing page creation software. Great at telling stories. One of the things that he did when he started, he said, you know what? I'm not the developer. I can't code this thing up. What I'm going to do is I'm going to make a list of my 100 people who I idolize, who I ideally would like to work with. I'm going to then find ways to get into their lives called his Dream 100, and just keep staying on top of them until they bring me into their world. And so he had people like a Facebook group moderator that had his audience and Tony Robbins and so on and so forth. And since then, not only has he gotten to all these Facebook groups because he did this by infiltrating the people, by people's lives and getting together with them, but by one of the things that he did by being in their world was he got his marketing, but he also started doing business with them. I see him with Tony Robbins at Tony Robbins events now all the time. Now Tony uses him as an example of what could be done if you follow Tony's ideas. Anyway, it's the Dream 100 idea, and that's just episode number 10 of this podcast. This whole podcast is full of techniques that he and his customers have used, what's worked, what's interesting, what's exciting. If you're into listening to what we're talking about here, you guys should go check out Russell Brunson's podcast. It is called Traffic Secrets, and it's based on his book and the techniques that he has used over the years himself. I think you dig him as a person, by the way. All right. So one of the ideas was Day Without Shoes. I saw Charlize Theron was doing this, Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders, Nordstrom, Microsoft, AOL. I keep seeing their names. What is Day Without Shoes? And then where did it come from?
Yeah, just a really simple idea. We had some college students at University of Pepperdine that were big fans of Tom's. They were the Thunder Lizards, as you just referred to it.
Yeah.
And they realized that a lot of people who just didn't know about Tom's, we were really small then, and a lot of people didn't know about the most important part, and that was that we were built to help kids get shoes. And so they decided to kind of protesting way, but in a way to get attention, just to spend a day not wearing shoes on campus. And every time someone said, "Hey, why aren't you wearing shoes?" they would say, "Well, there's millions of kids around the world that don't have shoes. And there's this company just down the street that is doing something about it." And they would tell our story. And it was genius. And so we caught on to it. They were in the newspaper and we were like, "Wow." And we invite them to the warehouse, which was our office at the time. And then the next year we said, "Hey, let's challenge other colleges to do this." So then they challenged, other colleges. And then it was a college thing for a while. And then companies got involved, like AOL and Microsoft. And, all these different companies started doing it. And, before we knew it, we had millions of people around the world going barefoot. And it was truly at the height of it, which was probably 2012. I mean, it was a phenomenon. I mean, literally, you would have kindergarten teachers in Korea going barefoot and Wall Street traders going barefoot and Demi Moore going on the Jay Leno show barefoot. And we didn't know any of these people. I mean, they just caught on to the idea because of social media and thought, "This is a cool thing. I'm going to partake in it." And sometimes if you just give people an opportunity to activate on something that they find interesting or important, it's amazing what can happen. And so Day Without Shoes was, I would say the most important thing to know about Day Without Shoes, for anyone who's listening that is, in marketing or entrepreneur, is this happened in the spring. And on this day, we specifically did not do any sales marketing. We didn't send out any emails. We didn't have any promotions. We didn't say buy now, buy now, buy now on the website. The whole website was dedicated. All of our social was dedicated to just showing people barefoot, right? So we purposely did not try to sell shoes on this one day of the year. This day was always our biggest sales day of the year, even bigger than Black Friday and Cyber Monday.
Wow. All right. So can this now happen today?
I think Patagonia did it recently, last year or two, when they said, we're going to close our stores. And then, they did it, or I think that was REI. Patagonia said, "We're going to give away 100% of the profits today." Like, I think when you do something that is authentic to your brand and that is connected to a bigger purpose, even today, now it needs to be creative. It can't be something that someone else has already done. So it's harder. But yeah, I think it absolutely can happen today. And, and a big part of, story and sharing story is what we're doing with Made For. And that's why we spent a year after the program was done. We could have just launched the company over a year ago, but instead we invited 1,300 people from all walks of life to do the program. And now we're taking their stories and their successes and the changes and transformations that happened in their life. And that's the only thing we're using to market Made For now is their stories. We're not out there kind of honking our own horn. We're just sharing the stories of our members and the changes that have happened in their life. And that's how we're getting more members.
I want to know how that's different from everyone else then who's selling their success stories, who's showing you can get fit if just like these people who took our shakes, who drank our vitamins, who went through our exercise program.
Okay. Yeah. I think that's a good question. I think a lot of it is who's telling the story. So I should be more specific in that, you know, what we're finding is that our Made For members themselves are sharing the story and sharing the months as they go through them on their own social media without any prodding from us. So it's different, I think, if we are the ones who are pushing it. That could be effective too in a Facebook ad or in an Instagram ad. But the most effective thing is when your customer themselves are the ones who are sharing the story, like the kids going barefoot at Pepperdine. And so what we're finding is that someone does the program, and we had a lot of HR professionals do the program initially, because I gave a speech in Vegas two summers ago, and it was an HR convention. And so I told them about what I was working on in my speech, and many of them signed up for the beta. And what we're finding is they did the program, and a lot of their coworkers, you know, saw them engaging with these unique water bottles or tools, and they asked about it. And then they shared ultimately how it affected them. And now we're seeing like whole, you know, kind of teams sign up for the program in larger companies. Or if someone does a program and then their wife wants to do it, or their partner wants to do it, or they want to get it, you know, you want to get their college age kid to do it. So a lot of it is just really based on people sharing their own story versus us kind of pushing the story ourselves.
You know what though, when I looked at how it's being promoted online, I see you telling other people's stories a lot. I think in fact, the call to action on the site is subscribe to our email newsletter while you'll hear these stories, right?
Yeah.
When I see how people report on you, it's all about the guy who created Tom's is now going to make you into a better person. And it feels like that's the first story. Am I right? Like, here's a person who's made it. Now he's going to show you how to make it. You respect how he made it. He's going to make you feel that comfortable with the way that you're going to make it.
Well, I think my personal story has become a big part of the initial, I think, media that came out. One, because I think it was, you know, surprising to people that I was leaving Tom's. And the second thing is what led to Made For and kind of meeting with all these different scientists from around the country was my own struggle in 2015 with having mild depression again. You know, I sold half of Tom's in 2014, stepped down from day-to-day responsibility, and, you know, 18 months later, found myself not feeling that fulfilled, not feeling that engaged with life, like kind of asking myself these big questions. And feeling like, gosh, I did everything that society told me to do. I, you know, built a great company, helped lots of people, got married, had these wonderful kids, had this, you know, wonderful home, and I still don't feel fulfilled. And so I recognized that there were a lot of things that I had skipped over in working so hard to build Tom's. And a lot of those things had to do with my own personal wellness. And as I started thinking about, like, what could I do to take control of my own wellness, like with the same tenacity and being proactive like I did in business, what I found was there were people who were really thriving, and there were common practices and habits that they were all practicing. And specifically what I found, and this was really with my business partner, Pat, who was in the military. He was a Navy SEAL for 9 years. He has a very kind of structured, focused brain on facts and what does science and what is proven to work. Is what I found was that there was actually a lot of science on personal well-being, and it just wasn't being communicated in a way that people could actually apply in their lives. And so as I started getting, you know, meeting with these different labs around the country, because I could get access to them because of my Tom resume, and sharing them that I was personally suffering, what I found was there was like a lot of very basic things that I kind of knew, but had never fully committed to integrating into my life. And that's when I realized that we could take this and create a program that could teach people in a different way. And two of the biggest things we learned was you could only learn one thing at a time. So, you know, you couldn't learn this in a podcast or reading a book and learn all 10 things in a weekend at a retreat or something. You really need to take your time in learning it and go through a deep learning process. And the second thing we learned was that digital was one of the biggest enemies in learning a new habit or practice. So as many new meditation apps and productivity apps and habit apps that there are out there right now, you know, I would be surprised to find very many people that find them really effective because they're constantly being interrupted with all the different notifications and all the other things on their phone. And so that's the other big thing we realized is it had to be analog. And so we built the whole program on those two tenets, is one thing a month, really focused on learning one new simple basic habit, and it's got to be completely analog. And I think that's what surprised a lot of people.
You know what, though, as I'm interviewing people, I see that a lot of them are kind of nuts, that they're at least through the period where they're building up. And it seems like maybe you had some of that experience yourself where you knew there were things you needed to do, but you just didn't do them. And
sure.
I feel I'm thinking about entrepreneurs who make themselves sick almost by working so hard. Isn't that the right way to go so hard on one thing that you exclude every other aspect of your life from your mind and make yourself sick almost while you're trying to make it?
I don't think so. I think that's the myth, and that's the story that creates this incredible dramatizing the entrepreneurial experience. I mean, I do think there are times in which that's necessary, and I think that's why you see most, you know, new breakout companies are started by people in their 20s because they don't have anything else to do. But I don't think it's absolutely necessary. And I definitely don't think that's the way that you want your workforce working. And most people aren't entrepreneurs. Most people have jobs and responsibilities and manage people. And you want those people to have a really strong mental health foundation. And so, I find that now, you know, kind of launching Made For and having just as much energy to share what we're doing there as I did when I started Tom's, but now practicing this stuff, I find that I can kind of do it all now. I can actually be incredibly effective in building this business and helping a lot of people, but also I can be a great dad and I can have, you know, a great social life. And I think it all comes from taking control of my life versus letting my business kind of control me.
Do you think now the one-for-one model will work with Made For, or that there's any kind of giving program that will stand out in a world where it feels like everybody's got a giving program?
Yeah, I don't think we're not really using a giving program per se to market Made For, but we do have a very important program that we committed to called Made For Everyone, where we never wanted price to be a deterrent for someone to do the program. And so we have a very generous scholarship program where anyone can apply, and we give scholarships everything from, you know, completely free to all you have to do is pay for the shipping to, you know, 25 or 50% off. And so we've had a lot of people take us up on that. And if someone's listening right now and they're like, gosh, I'm really in a rut, I really could use something like this, but I'm also really financially struggling because of what's happened, you know, in the last couple of months with COVID-19, then definitely go to the website, click on the Made For Everyone tab and apply for a scholarship, because it's something that we're really proud of. And that's our way of, in a sense, creating a business that helps people, but also doesn't exclude people who can't afford it.
I thought you were going to send them to what's the URL that you guys created? You created a URL to give people some discount off of the program. Do you remember what the discount is? And I think the URL.
Yeah, it's 20% off the program. And really, I just got information from Casey. You just go to madefor.com, and when you check out, you just type in MF Mixergy and you get 20% off.
Got it. The thing that I remember about you is when we were living in LA, I guess it's been about a decade ago, maybe a little more, my wife organized an event for Tom's Shoes. I go, what are you organizing an event for a shoe company for? She did. She just believed in what you were doing. At the time, it was just radical. And she gravitated towards that model. To this day, I texted her. I said, I'm about to talk to the founder of Tom's. What was the event that you organized? She goes, you're putting me on the spot. I'm taking care of the kids. I don't remember, but I do know it was for Tom's. I organized it. And I thought, wow, this is such an amazing brand that she just organized something. She remembers the brand more even than the thing she organized.
Yeah, wow.
And then since then, I have to say that was when she was volunteering and she was exploring this whole model. She has then gone on to help for-profit companies here in Silicon Valley, in San Francisco, with their nonprofit mission. So she ran Yahoo for Good for a few years. She's now running PagerDuty.org. I think no one who's not in DevOps understands what PagerDuty is, but they're a well-known company that I got to watch go public on the New York Stock Exchange. And they are now trying to do good in the world too. And I feel like this model that you innovated, beyond the direct numbers that we could attribute to you, the eyesight that you've helped people with, the shoes you've given people, I feel like you've created a model for other businesses. That's exciting.
To me, that is, you know, that is one of the things I'm most proud of, is all the companies that I've seen, you know, follow suit, whether it's just having a mission that is connected to helping people or the planet, or a one-for-one model. And I think, you know, there's very few entrepreneurs today that go and launch a company without considering how they're going to have impact with their success and their revenue. And I think, you know, there's been a lot of amazing companies in this space, and I think that it's the way of the future. I don't think it'll ever go back, because ultimately customers have so much choice now, more than ever, of the companies they support, and they want to feel good about the companies that they support. And that's how you can build that connection with your customer.
What I dig about, I should never go to madefor.com. It's actually getmadefor.com. I should never go there when I'm talking to someone, because it's just so beautifully built. Like, look at this freaking thing. My kid, as I was prepping for this conversation this morning, watched me scroll and do this part right here where the box opens up. Isn't that great? Like, how many times do you do that over and over?
We spend a lot of time. I mean, it's so funny, because, you know, the difference between starting a company when you have nothing and starting a company when you have a lot of resources is just the amount of time it takes. Like, because when you don't have any money and you have to start a company, like, we went from literally having the idea for Tom's. I had the idea on a farm in Argentina in February. Into February, and I sold my first pair of shoes on Cinco de Mayo. Okay. So March, April, May, 2.5 months later, I go from an idea on a farm to selling a shoe on a website. Okay. Made for, we spent 2.5 years. A lot of it was because we had to do a lot of work with scientists to really prove that these things would work. But then just building everything just takes so much more time, because you have the resources and you want it to be perfect. And so I would say I appreciate the compliment on the website, and there's a lot of hard work that went into it. But to entrepreneurs that are out there, it's kind of like you said earlier with your sponsor, like, it's a sketch, you know, and sometimes a sketch is better than trying to make something perfect, because you're going to get feedback and you're going to learn. And there's already things on the website we want to change. So it's really funny that you brought that up.
The website, for people who want to go check it out for themselves, is getmadefor.com. I just think your stuff just looks beautiful. And I understand the model. And I understand that in a world where everyone is coming at us digitally, that you're coming at us with analog. You're coming at us with, it's not just even, what did I see? The hourglass. It's not just an hourglass that you physically hold in your hand. It looks like something from, I don't know, the MoMA or someone's grandfather's desk, right?
Thank you. Yeah. I give the credit to my partner there, Pat. Like, he is so fixated on just quality and detail, and every single tool we design is like a piece of art. I mean, like, you know, so this is like the water bottle here, and you can see, like, I mean, it's beautiful glass, bamboo. It's got the beads to keep track every time you drink a bottle.
That's how it keeps track of it. I thought maybe you had a digital counter on it.
No, no digital. No, it's all analog.
It's the bead.
Yeah, little beads that you move. And there's actually some real neuroscience behind the kind of serotonin release that you get when you move a bead. Like, the physical tactile moving of it, of like, I just finished a bottle, I got to move a bead. There's real science behind that, what's happening in your brain when that happens. So if it was a digital, you know, tracker, it wouldn't have near the same impact.
I noticed that. I noticed as I traveled around the world, no matter what culture I went to, they seem to have some kind of beads either on their hands or in their pockets, right? Argentines would have it.
Yeah.
All right. I wish I could just say madefor.com, but some Spanish company has that. It's right. Doesn't that kill you?
I'm trying to buy it. Get made for. That's what we got.
It's getmadefor.com. Go check them out. And I want to thank the two sponsors, the sponsor that we just talked about and likened to a Sketchpad. It's HostGator. If you need a website hosted, go to HostGator.com/Mixergy. If you're with a hosting company and you want to cut costs, it's an easy way to cut costs right now. HostGator.com/Mixergy. And finally, now that this podcast is over, go check out my friend Russell Brunson's podcast. It will give you a bunch of ideas, again, all related to you through stories, for how you can get more traffic, more people to pay attention to what you're doing. It's called Traffic Secrets, and whatever podcast app you're listening to me, it will be there. And if you've got a smart speaker like I do, you can play it there too. Blake, congratulations, and thank you so much for being here.
Andrew, thank you so much. It was really fun talking today.
You bet. Bye. Bye, everyone.